Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello and welcome to this episode of GoTo Unscripted. I'm Charles Humble. I'm a freelance techie editor, author and consultant. And this is part of a series of podcasts that I'm doing for GoTo, talking to software engineering leaders. Today, we're joined by Laura Tacco, CTO at DX, a developer experience company. She's been building developer tools and working on improving developer productivity for over 10 years, all the way from the heyday of infrastructure as a service and platform as a service on cloud through Docker and containers, CI/CD, and now as part of DX. She's also an executive coach for engineering leaders and an expert in building world-class engineering organizations that consistently deliver outstanding results. Laura has coached CTOs and other engineering leaders from startups to the Fortune 500 and also facilitates a popular course on metrics and engineering team performance. Laura, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Charles. I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
Thank you. Likewise. So tell me about your role at DX. What do you do day-to-day as a CTO there?
Yeah, CTO roles can be really different from company to company, and DX is a very unique company. So we're an engineering intelligence platform. We're out there to help our customers measure and most importantly, improve developer productivity. So on any given day, I spend most of my time actually externally facing as a partner to our customers. So that might look like me doing an executive alignment session with VPs, or it could look like me having a CTO conversation or coaching some of our champions on how to refine their messaging, talking up to their executive team or their board. It's very different day to day. I don't have a typical schedule, which I really enjoy. And I really like the ability of getting to spend a lot of my time working with our customers and learning about their problems, because that helps us build a better product.
Right. Is this your first CTO role? Have you done it elsewhere before?
Yeah, this is my first CTO role. Before was kind of moved traditionally through director of engineering, senior director, was VP at a few companies, and then moved into a CTO role.
So what do you like about the role? Do you enjoy doing it? And what is it you enjoy about it?
So as I mentioned, CTO roles can be really variable from company to company. Some CTOs are focused just fully internally on managing the team, building the team from the inside. Some CTOs are focused more externally. And so what I like about this particular role is that I have a lot of autonomy to do improvements on the inside. But most importantly, I really enjoy being able to be a partner for our customers and use the, as you said, in your lovely introduction of me, the decade plus that I've been spending in developer productivity to help them just have some shortcuts, not make the same mistakes twice if they don't need making. So that gives me a lot of satisfaction.
Excellent. And I said as well in the intro that as well as your role as CTO at DX, you also coach other CTOs. So how did you get into doing that?
Yeah, I left my kind of cushy corporate VP of engineering role during the pandemic and decided that I wanted to do something a little bit different, which I know is a risky move, but it just felt like the time was right. I was feeling like I wanted to scale my impact, and I knew that one way to do that would be to work with people at many different organizations. And throughout my engineering leadership career, it had become abundantly clear that coaching and supporting other leaders in their own leadership journey was a skill that I'm particularly good at. And that is somewhat uncommon, and especially to be focused on engineering leadership coaching. So I built my MVP, got proof from the market that this was something that had product market fit, and decided to build up a coaching practice. And then at the same time, I built up a course on developer productivity, measuring developer productivity, improving it. And those two things together just got me into a lot of different organizations, working with my clients and doing a lot of breadth when it comes to seeing lots of different problems across the industry right now, which was really, really rewarding to help those leaders kind of find their voice, find their solutions, but also for me personally to complete my own encyclopedia of knowledge and keep me up to date on the challenges that real leaders are facing right now so that I can, you know, better serve them in the future.
What are the skills that you see that are most commonly missing from the CTOs that you coach?
I think that most CTOs and most leaders in general have a deficit of practice when it comes to what you might think of foundational leadership skills, things like giving difficult feedback, setting clear expectations. There's a fine line, and I think the line is particularly sensitive and maybe particularly small in engineering between micromanagement and just setting clear expectations. And most of the CTOs and VPs and other senior leaders that I work with, their biggest fear is not being a micromanager or becoming one. I guess their biggest fear is becoming a micromanager. And because we have that fear, we tend to pull back when it comes to giving direction, giving necessary detail. And this leads to what I call the kind of like the micromanagement spiral of doom, because we don't give our teams enough context. Then what happens is they underperform or they don't perform to our expectations. So we have to go and get in the details. And that's micromanagement that we were trying to avoid. We feel bad about that. Doesn't feel good for anyone involved. And then the next time we have an opportunity, we pull back and the cycle just repeats itself and repeats itself and repeats itself. And this is a fundamental skill that most CTOs who are new to their role, and even CTOs who have been doing their role for 20 plus years, they don't recognize that pattern, and they've actually never been taught how to set a really clear expectation so that people do what you need them to do on the first try without you having to intervene.
Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. I was just reflecting over my own movement into CTO and thinking, yeah, that all sounds very familiar, actually. It's that thing of trying to, as you say, trying to give people that's the direction we're going in and then stepping back and letting them find a path there. And it's a hard thing to do. And I think as well as that shift from, particularly if you're technical, as I was and you obviously were, I think that shift into management broadly is quite hard because you suddenly find all the things that you were good at before and got you where you are suddenly not the things that really matter anymore. Actually, on that, absolutely. Do you have any advice for people that are kind of feeling that way?
I think any CTO who's moving into their new role and having the self-awareness of, hey, what got me here isn't going to get me there. That's a really important and it's kind of like your metamorphosis, your evolution as a leader. One of the best pieces of advice that I can give leaders in that role is that you have to think of yourself now, not as an engineering leader, even though that's your area of specialty, but you are a business leader. And until you fully embrace the fact that you are operating on a business level, you're going to hold yourself back because you're going to stay thinking about just the engineering side of things and not apply your leadership to the whole business, which is what the business needs and expects of you. So the sooner you can overcome that hurdle, and a lot of it is putting our ego aside because we've gotten praise, money, you know, celebration based on our technical skills up until this point. And then suddenly to be in an environment where that is no longer going to give you the praise and the validation that you seek. Not only that, but it actually works against you when you do those things. That is really, really difficult just on a human level. It really rattles your whole identity. So there's a little bit of, you know, self-acceptance that needs to happen, a little bit of introspection and kind of figuring out who am I? And it can be a very jolting transition, even if it feels like a very natural next career step. So give yourself time to go through that. Let yourself sort of grieve the brilliant technologist that you were before and understand that you are now entering, it's not a new chapter, it's like a new book. And just be okay with that and recognize that that's going to happen. Ideally, you have this dialogue with yourself before taking the role. But I think a lot of CTOs don't quite understand the gravity of the change or even moving into a VP role until you've already gotten into that role and you're starting to feel some of those pains.
A related question, I guess, is how you manage your old technical, your old programming skills to try and limit the atrophy, or do you just accept that they are going to atrophy and that's the reality of it?
Yeah, you will not find me coding something that's going to production. Definitely not. And, you know, every, and again, you know, every CTO role is different and every company is different. Some companies that are very big have huge engineering headcount, have a CTO that codes. And that's okay if that's the contract that you have. For me in my particular role right now, that's not part of the contract that I have. Like, that's not the interface that we have. And I would be definitely a bottleneck. And that was also the case in my VP roles. I am not a hands-on coding type of leader. And, you know, you do, though, need to keep your technical skills up to date, because it's very difficult to lead a team if you don't have any expertise in what they're doing anymore. Two things about that is, like, one, the principles more or less stay the same. The physics of software development stay the same, even if the tools are new. So as long as you have a very good, solid technical foundation, you know, a lot of those things aren't going to, they're not going to change from month to month. I think the second thing is, like, do enough on your own. It's a side project. It's reading documentation. It's watching conference talks, whatever it might be, to make sure that you have the necessary technical skill required to do your job, to evaluate performance, to make technical decisions, to guide technical decision making, if that's your flavor. So you don't need to be coding every day, but you can't forget that that part of you exists either.
Yes. Yeah. There's something else which I've struggled with, and I think quite a lot of people struggle with, which is that when you're coding for a living, you have this very immediate feedback and reward thing. We've sort of touched on this already, but, you know, that kind of instant dopamine hit that you get. And when you start managing for a living, that really isn't there anymore. Is that something that you find with your own clients? And do you have kind of advice on that?
Yeah, actually, anecdotally, this happened to me last week, where something happened at work and I said, oh, finally, it came true. The thing that I thought was going to happen did. And I went back in Slack, and it was like a year and 2 months ago that I said, okay, we're going to do this and this is going to happen, but it's probably going to take a year. And I was right. But man, it's like, it is difficult when you're used to, you know, doing something, running your tasks, they're green, pushing it up to your main branch, running all your CI integrations, shipping it to production. You know, as a individual contributor, I was shipping code to production, user-facing stuff, like 6-7 times a day. Mm-hmm. And now I make a decision that takes me a year and 2 months to figure out if I was right or not. So that's part of the game. I think that's also part of the mindset shift of understanding you're a business leader now. One of the common things I hear is, like, I can't, how am I supposed to get work done? Because now I'm in all these meetings. The meetings are the work. The meetings are the work. And once we can start to understand that, it just relieves a lot of this pressure that we put on ourselves to be a different person, or that we're, you know, that we're doing something wrong. We're not doing anything wrong. This is just your role is different. But also find those moments in the day that you can do something. I don't know, fill in a box on a spreadsheet, a color, or, like, you know, post on LinkedIn. That gives nice immediate gratification. There's definitely things in your day to give you that gratification. What's helped me is just understanding the impact of the decisions that I'm making are incredibly huge. And so they just take time, but I can break them down into smaller milestones so that I can still make sure I'm on track without having to, like, put something out there into the void and hope a year and 2 months later that the thing actually happened the way I thought it would.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. In these more senior roles, particularly if we have a lot of managerial reports, so when we get to that sort of manager of managers type role, we tend to need kind of signals to understand how one of our particular teams is performing. So change failure rate might be an example of that. How do you identify the signals?
That is a very thoughtful question. I think there's two ways that I generally have seen it be done. One is that we have kind of a common language, and we have a desire for consistency in reporting from the top down. So this is a situation where, you know, every team is responsible for, you mentioned change failure rate. So maybe they're looking at DORA metrics, or they're using a different framework, but we want to be looking at every service or every team, depending on where the lines fall, based on, you know, looking at them on the same criteria so that I can see if something is amiss. That's definitely one strategy. I've also worked in different scenarios where the teams themselves are highly variable, or they're working in very highly specialized engineering functions. So one example, a client that I had, they're working on, you know, computations for figuring out the force that waves crashing against solar farms in the middle of the ocean? Like, what's the force that those waves crash? And like, how does that impact structural engineering? This is really different from JavaScript application that's going out. you know, these are just two really different, but in the same company, you've got lots of different types of engineering and complexities in software. And so for that situation, the approach that, and not just this company, but many have taken, is each team is responsible for defining productivity as it is important to them and useful to them to improve, and then their own metrics and reporting on that. And so, you know, depending on your situation, you might find that one or the other is more appropriate for the particular goals that you have.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And in the same way, I think that those signals can change depending on where you are in the organization, but they can also change over time, like at different phases within the business as well.
Yeah, I do see that to happen as well. I think the metrics and the signal of, you know, how is this team performing? How is this component or system performing? It does somewhat follow a trajectory of data literacy and continuous improvement mastery. Teams that are just getting started with continuous improvement might be looking at really granular, small focus of data because that's all they have capacity to kind of interpret and act upon. And we might build that up over the course of 6, 12, 18 months to something a lot more robust and a lot more standardized across the whole organization. But that's very common, especially also to see it happen only in a subsection of teams, so, or a subset of teams. So maybe there's, you know, two teams who are kind of the flagship teams for continuous improvement and using metrics for productivity and improving productivity. And then we can see them have some success and that might snowball a bit and then kind of fan out into the other teams until we have a whole organization who's then able to exploit the knowledge and lessons that that team has learned to bring those habits and those processes to their, to the rest of the organization.
Right. Yes. And something we talk about a lot in our industry is this idea of developer productivity and what that means and how we measure it and so on. I had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Gail Murphy for this show, and we had quite a detailed discussion about this. Her work's been hugely influential on me. But because I want to talk about the DX Core Fall framework and the metrics with that, can we maybe start with what your definition of what developer productivity actually is?
Yeah, developer productivity is actually very difficult to define. And we've had research trying to define it since the beginning of software development, I think, as Gail mentioned in her interview. We used to define it based on lines of code. My own definition, which I don't like to have my own definition for things. I want to have kind of a common language that we use as an industry. And so I'll kind of fall back to Core 4 because that really is my thinking codified in a framework, which is that developer productivity first is multidimensional. It is about, you know, output that leads to outcomes. It's about quality. It's about the developer experience, but it's also about business impact. And it has to be about those things together. Otherwise, we get too fixated on one part and we can lose sight of actually the whole system. Mm-hmm. Developer productivity is a team sport and it is very complex. So we want to have a definition that is sufficiently complex to encapsulate it, which unfortunately makes it sometimes difficult to reason about and difficult to work with. But we're hoping that one of our hopes of the Core 4 was that we were simplifying and unifying. And we have seen that it does help organizations get their head around the definition of developer productivity, give common language to all of their leaders in the organization, and skip that debate, what is developer productivity, at the beginning, and just get to, let's try to start improving it. And here are some tools to do that.
Yes, it's interesting you talk about that common language thing, because I think it's something that gets missed a lot, but the words really matter because they shape how you think about something. And I think it's actually quite an important point that people sort of overlook a lot. Tell me about, so you've recently released the DX Core 4 framework, so the updates to the framework. Can you tell me a bit about the framework? How did you build it in the first place?
Yeah, very brief kind of tour through developer productivity research. As Gail mentioned in her interview with you, we've been trying to measure developer productivity since the beginning of software. We started with some very straightforward measurements, lines of code, for example. And I think the kind of where we landed a decade and a half ago was like, perhaps this is not the best thing. You know, there's variance in computer, like in programming languages, there's a lot of variance in the types of tasks that engineers are, you know, responsible for. And so perhaps this is not the actual best thing. About a decade ago, DORA came on the scene with these four key DORA metrics. And these have been kind of adopted as somewhat like the canon of objective measurement of organizational performance, and that kind of got interpreted as like, these are developer productivity metrics. DORA was really meant to measure software delivery capabilities, not necessarily widespread software or widespread developer productivity. But, you know, in the absence of a better alternative, DORA was a great one. And often that kind of, we kind of latched onto that as, hey, these metrics are really useful. And so we're going to use them. But there was still quite a lot of the story to tell. And so Dr. Nicole Forsgren and some of the other researchers involved in DORA then came together to do research around the SPACE framework of developer productivity. SPACE is a very comprehensive framework. It is not a recommendation of what to measure. It just describes the components or the dimensions of developer productivity. And so one of the main theses of SPACE was that activity is just the A part. It's only one fifth. And there's satisfaction, there's communication, there's lots of other things. Also, self-report or self-perception of productivity is really important. And so we're starting to get more kind of more nuanced definition, more comprehensive definition. And then the DevEx framework came on the scene again from that same research team, kind of in their next generation, talking about cognitive load, flow state, and feedback loops as the components to a really good developer experience, which leads to great organizational outcomes. There's so much research out there. And again, we've really just scratched the surface when it comes to research on this. But despite all of the great research, we were still being asked the question, what should I even measure? And so Abhi Noda, who's the CEO and co-founder of DX, and I came together and we said, what can we do to simplify this, to unify these frameworks so that people didn't have to sit there stalled for 3 months when they wanted to get started with this, so they could just pick up something that was well-tested and well-researched and get started quickly? And so that's really what the Core 4 was born out of, just a desire to facilitate, you know, to encourage leaders or to give them something that they could start using immediately that's easy to deploy, that is research-backed, evidence-based, and tested in the field. And we came up with the Core 4, which just unifies all of these frameworks together so that leaders don't have to spend, you know, 3-6 months trying to figure out which metric should I pick, and they can just get started with the improvement part, because that's what we're after anyway.
Right. Okay. So let's dig into the framework a bit. So it has four areas. Mm-hmm. You have speed, effectiveness, quality, and impact. And then they have a key and secondary metrics for each one of those. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about some of the different metrics for each of those categories and how they were arrived at?
Sure. I'll talk a little bit about the key metrics for each of them. So as you said, speed, effectiveness, quality, and impact. The categories here really hold each other in tension. And it's important that when we look at Core 4, we're looking at all of the metrics together. We can't just look at one value from one of the categories in isolation, because it doesn't mean much in isolation. Starting with speed, this is actually the most controversial one, so we can start with it. We're measuring this in diffs per engineer. So pull requests, merge requests per engineer. Not at an individual level, and this is incredibly important, not at an individual level, but in an aggregate. And this is a metric that actually myself, and you can find a conference talk of Abhi on stage telling people not to use this metric. And I have definitely said the same thing in the past as well, because the risk of misuse for this particular metric is very high, because it automatically, people go to, oh, okay, you know, Charles had 4 PRs this last week, and so now he has 3 this week. What's wrong? Are you slacking? You know, are you on vacation? Whatever. But when we look at it as a system metric, as a measurement that answers the question, hey, how easy is it for engineers to get work done in the development system that they have access to at this particular company? It is so useful. And this has been, you know, shown in research at Microsoft, Meta uses this, Uber, I believe as well, that the benefit outweighs the risk as long as we felt that we could sufficiently educate people around how to use this, and putting it in the boundaries of a framework also was something. But you know, the authors ourselves, like, we debated about, is this the right metric? Is it not? One of the things that we wanted to include in the framework also were peer benchmarks. And so benchmarkability and ease of measurement were also things that we considered when choosing each metric. And PRs per engineer fits both of those criteria. And it's a very, very useful metric for system performance. So that is the speed part. I'll reiterate, not an individual level. I'm not interested in how many PRs you closed last week.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to highlight that, actually, because it's one of those things, if you do it at an individual level, it's so easy for developers to game. If they think that they're being measured on that, well, I'll just submit more PRs then. And, you
absolutely
know, and that's the problem. So I think you have to, I think with all of these things, you have to measure at an overall team level. And the other thing that she said there, which I just wanted to sort of pull out and highlight a little bit, is that some of the metrics that you've chosen in this are kind of effectively in tension with each other. And mm-hmm. so they kind of act as a bit of a self-balancing force on the overall framework. Is that kind of right? Can you talk a little bit to that?
Yeah, so let's take the next two, effectiveness and quality, into consideration. So effectiveness is a measure of how effective engineers can be in the systems in which they work. And so this is measured by developer experience. A developer experience index is an average of some developer experience drivers that gives you an indication of how good is your developer experience based, or like, in comparison to others. So, you know, for example, let's say we're trying to increase the amount of PRs per week, and then developer experience goes down, or we're trying to increase quality by adding in a bunch of manual QA steps and like a bunch of other stuff that just makes it really, really difficult. First of all, we should expect to see speed go down. That throughput of PRs is going to go down, but also the developer experience is going to go down. So what we want to see is these numbers moving together. That's the real signal. And that's why we need to see them all together and not just look at one, because looking at one, even over time, doesn't really tell us much information. We want to see how they're moving together. What we want to see is increased speed and higher quality. Those two things should move together. A better developer experience, that also moves with it. And then teams that have great developer experience, high quality, they're able to get work done, also are able to spend more time on innovation, on new features versus keeping the lights on in maintenance. And so that's the fourth category. This is something fairly new and novel for engineering or developer productivity framework, because what's been missing and what was missing for all of the leaders that we were working with in the field was, how do I actually connect things like change failure rate or developer experience back to the business and make it useful and meaningful for my peers or for the executive team that I have to present to? And so the way to do that is to help understand what those things get you, which is more time to spend on innovation. Because a lot of this performance is contextual. If your competitor has more time to spend on innovation than you do, because, you know, you have a poor developer experience, or they're investing more in their developer experience, it's a question of when, not if, they're going to outpace you and overtake you. And so we wanted to make the distinction and that connection really, really clear, that developer experience is not ping pong and beer and better toilet paper for developers. That's not what this is, right? And I think truthfully, and I think you're laughing because, you know, there is a bit of, you know, definition drift, we could maybe call it, mm-hmm. of developer experience, like the marketability of it to executives and to people that care about the business and are making the decisions about where the money goes might not see that this isn't about ping pong and beer. This is about reducing friction for the biggest investment that your company is making and the place where truly innovation is make or break. So it's not a vitamin, it's painkiller is how I try to phrase it. But that's another reason that we need to have this conversation, talk about it with authority in terms of business impact. And that's why including that impact dimension in the core four was critical to its success.
Yeah, I really like this as well. I mean, I've had a lot of conversations with people kind of the other way, where it's been like, you know, oh, the business won't sponsor me to pay down technical debt or whatever it is. And I'm like, well, have you explained to them what that even means? Actually, can you explain to me what that even means? Because I'll wager your definition and my definition may well not be the same. You know, a lot of the time I think we use things like technical debt to mean getting rid of things we don't like. And it's that importance of tying it back to, you know, that there's something I did a bunch of shortcuts for O'Reilly last year. And there's an example in there of, you know, our app is crashing and people are abandoning us at checkout or something like that. And we're, you know, losing 1 in 5, say, and we think it'll take us 4 weeks to fix. And we think that if we fix that, then that drop off should halve or something. And now you've got something that you can actually measure, but also the business understands why you're doing the thing. And as you say, it's not ping pong tables. It's not beer. At the end of the day, it's like, well, what impact is this actually having that people who are sponsoring you can see and reason? So I really like the impact part of the framework.
Yeah. Technical debt is a phrase or a term that I really don't like, but I still use it because when I talk to other technologists, they know exactly what I mean. But when I talk to people who are not technologists, they don't know what it means. And I think for too long, it's been used as a catch-all phrase for things that we want to do again, things that we want to get rid of, things that you shouldn't ask us questions about because we know better than you. And, you know, for a long time, engineering did sort of have a blank check to do a lot of what we wanted to do self-directed. And there, the accountability piece wasn't necessarily there. And I think we had like a really good run, but that time is really over.
Yeah.
Accountability is here. Not that companies weren't holding engineering leaders accountable before, but it's a very different environment now in the last 5 years, I think, than it was if you looked 15 years ago, what we were doing. And so I think there's a whole generation of engineering leaders who have really underdeveloped business case skills because they came up in their leadership during that time when we actually weren't really expected to talk about the ROI of this particular project. And it was fine for us to sort of wave our hands and say, we know better, trust us, we have to do this. Nope. You know, and it wasn't a negotiation. We weren't trying to gauge, okay, what should we do first? This customer facing thing or this internal customer facing thing? Because once we think about paying down technical debt as serving your internal customers of people who are developing on your platform, we can start to draw some parallels between a customer, you know, external customer facing thing, internal customer facing thing, and calculate the ROI. So when I think about tech debt, I think about it in terms of, you know, let's actually be clear about what this is doing. Is this making our system more reliable? Is this helping us avoid a security issue? Is this helping us fix a current security issue? Get really, really, really clear about what is happening. And then we need to know who's the audience? Who is it impacting? Is this 10 individual developers who work on this component twice a year? Or does this impact something that every single developer at our company has to do once a week, and it's taking them 3 times as long as it could? And so the ROI is going to be not just time recovered and the salary equivalent that we could put that, but also answer the question, like, what could we bring to market faster?
Yeah.
These are the ways that we need to start putting together business cases around technical debt in order for it to be relevant to the business. And going back to how we started, you know, our conversation today, you are a business leader if you are an engineering leader, and you must think about your decision making in terms of money. That's the language of business. And I'm fine to catch all the flack and all the negative comments on LinkedIn whenever I say something like this, but, you know, better that you hear it from me now and get mad about it than lose your job over it in 12 months time because you're not practicing what you need to practice in order to be an effective leader.
100%. I really like your point there about the fact that lots of the current crop of leaders kind of grew up in this time when IT was, not really held accountable in quite the way that it, quite the way that it is. That's a fantastic insight, actually, because you're right. It's a relatively new thing because we're such an expensive resource now for all kinds of reasons, good and bad. People do, you know, like people do want to understand, well, what's the impact of what you're doing? But I think that is a relatively new thing. It's a fantastic insight, I think.
Yeah. And I have to, you know, I don't have a ton of evidence yet other than my own anecdotes, which like, right, the plural of anecdote is an evidence. But what I do find out there in, you know, in my coaching practice are like engineering leaders who are between the ages of, you know, late 20s to early 40s, who maybe started their engineering leadership journey after the 2008 economic crash. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of where I've been able to pinpoint it. It's like these, you know, late 20 to early 40. And then when I coach leaders who are in their 50s or in their late 50s, 60s, they tend to have a different amount of business acumen. And I've noticed this actually very recently where I was able to kind of put together that hypothesis is like, I think it's actually because of when you came to, you know, came of age as an engineering leader in this sort of heyday where money was free and we could do whatever we wanted to when it was about ping pong and beer. But I'm just interested to see how that plays out in the future and how long it takes for those leaders to kind of correct themselves or educate themselves up to where they need to be in order to thrive in the further stages of their career.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. We have a lot of different frameworks for measuring productivity, bringing it back to that. So obviously we've mentioned DORA and SPACE and Core 4, and there are others. How would you go about choosing a framework? I mean, I presume you would say, well, just use Core 4 and everything is good. But in all seriousness, how would you pick a framework?
Yeah, I think there's some organizational context that needs to be considered here. You need to understand who's the audience and what are we actually using this for? Because there's different use cases for metrics. And often leaders don't quite comprehend or think about the subtleties between those use cases. You should think about your metrics as a product. Product mindset for metrics. Your metrics are a product. They need to be solving a problem for your customers that they are willing to pay for. I know we're not actually exchanging money here, but attention and use are the currency that they're using. So if you are trying to, you know, you need metrics for local teams for continuous improvement so that they can identify bottlenecks in their own workflows, that's going to be a really different set of metrics than the metrics that you want to have on your board slides to report on once a quarter. So I might recommend Core 4 for that unifying common language across the whole organization to use for reporting, performance reporting, to use for reporting on the board. But an individual frontline team isn't going to have a lot of success improving software quality by only looking at the change failure rate. It's a great diagnostic metric for them to look at once a quarter. It's an output metric, but they might need smaller metrics that might actually not belong to a particular framework. It's just that they're using the framework to inform what metrics they pick. Of course, my short answer is always start with the Core 4 because it is a unification of DORA, SPACE, and DevEx. So you don't have to choose between those because it's often set up, oh, okay, are you going to do DORA or are you going to do SPACE? The reality is that you do both of them at the same time. And that's really clearly expressed in how we designed the Core 4 framework. So my short answer, of course, is to start there, but truly think about your metrics as a product. Who are they for? What information are they looking for? What questions do they have to answer? What decisions do they have to make? That is going to inform where you want to start and how you want to sort of market or position these internally.
We've talked to some of them actually, but what are the pitfalls of the metrics? They seem to be having a bit of a moment, but do you have any concerns around using them?
Yeah, I mean, they are having a bit of a moment. There's definitely a lot to be concerned about when introducing metrics. So one, I'll just kind of give you a high altitude tour of all the things that can go wrong. You mentioned gamification of metrics at the beginning of our discussion around this, and that is a real concern for a lot of leaders. My bottom line here is that we know how groups of people behave when metrics are being used to measure performance, especially in public or somewhat public, like in within a company. And so it's our responsibility to design a better system. If you're worried about gamification of the metrics, it's not a problem with your developers. It's a problem with the system of metrics. Mm-hmm. And so using a robust framework like Core 4, which also includes developer experience and qualitative data, can help insulate against that. But that's definitely one concern. It's not a reason not to use metrics, though. It's kind of universally there, that threat of gamification. You know, there's also the argument that developers are going to feel spied on. They're going to lose trust in leadership, and that absolutely can happen. Make sure that you're being very transparent around what decisions are going to be made, who has access to the data, why it's being collected. All of these things, if you don't give answers to them, people make up their own answers. And don't let that happen, I guess, is my advice there. I think the other kind of challenge from a leadership perspective, and also the worry, is, are we measuring the right things? And are we missing a really, really important part of our performance, or an important piece of the puzzle that, because we don't have visibility into it, we're going to be making a mistake for 18 months before we even realize that we're making a mistake. And so there, you know, there's a lot of ways that people can use metrics incorrectly, over-optimize on certain things, lose trust with our organization. So it needs to be really thoughtful and, most importantly, transparent with your organization about what these are doing, what purpose they serve, and then what decisions are being made with them and what happens next.
I'm thinking of things that have been having a bit of a moment. I know you've been studying Gen AI in the context of sort of software development. So what are some of the things that you found out there?
We actually have a new field guide to improving the use of Gen AI in engineering organizations. So this is a kind of a vendor neutral study that we looked at 180 companies and tried to understand the companies that are having a lot of success with Gen AI tooling. What are they actually using it for? And some of the things were even to me very surprising. So one of the big themes, which was reiterated in the report that Dora did just a few months ago about Gen AI, this was like a standalone report, not their normal state of DevOps report, but a standalone Gen AI report. They found that companies that have very strong executive sponsorship, very clear compliance rules, very clear kind of top-down mandate, maybe not the right word, but very clear instructions on what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, had, I think it's a 451, if my memory serves me correctly, higher a percent increase in adoption, simply because developers weren't left asking the question, am I going to get fired for this? Like, is this okay? Does this violate our licensing? Is this am I going to be replaced by AI, because now I'm using AI to do my job? So clear definition of what's acceptable, what's not, compliance from the top is incredibly important for adoption. And then on the other side is that, like any tool, engineers need training and support in order to know how to use AI AI assisted development in the best way. So it's not just, I'm going to buy GitHub Copilot licenses for my whole organization, and then 3 months later, check in and magically we have 10x productivity. We still need to train engineers how to prompt well, how to do recursive prompting, you know. And surprisingly, one of the things that I'll share from the report was, we found that code generation was actually not the most common use case for engineers who were using it to save the most time. It was stack trace analysis, particularly in the context of Java development. So being able to feed it this like really long, gross error and saying, tell me why is this happening? What are your suggestions for fixing this? That is a huge, huge time saver, because the cognitive load to do that independently is so incredibly high, and AI doesn't ever get tired. You know, it's like has basically unlimited cognitive capacity. And that was a huge time saver for developers who reported saving an hour or more by using Gen AI coding assistance each week.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think in a way, there's a bit of this that ties back to our conversation about metrics and the very early days of metrics and, you know, measuring lines of code as developer productivity, which we've kind of moved away from because it's a terrible measure of productivity. Mm-hmm. And I find some of the early marketing messages around Gen AI is, oh, well, you'll be able to code faster, as if like typing was the hard bit. But typing has never been the hard bit. Do you know what I mean? We can all, those of us that do this for a living, the typing is, you know, we're good at that bit. But I think the stack trace is actually a really good example of, oh yeah, that makes total sense, because you're not asking it to do anything, but it can't really do. It can't really be creative in the proper sense of the word, but it can absolutely analyze stuff that it's seen before and say, well, it looks like this. And that could be a huge time saver.
Yeah.
I think that's really, really interesting. How do you go about, we've talked a lot about measuring developer performance. How do you measure manager performance? How do you go about that?
Yeah, again, something I think that's really non-standard across the organization. So if you even go and you can do like a little experiment, if you go to LinkedIn and you look at job descriptions for software engineers, we've sort of landed on some kind of common definition of what a software engineer one versus a software engineer two or senior software engineer, like those distinctions in those career ladders, because those roles are hugely prevalent in our industry. There's just a lot of them. We have some kind of standard definition. Management is not quite as standardized. And so company to company, there's a lot of different criteria. Managers have a few sort of essential functions. They need to support their team and they need to keep their team unblocked. I think if you don't feel that that's happening, there's a few things that you can try to do about it. Of course, managing up is a skill in and of itself that I think every software engineer needs to understand how to do. It's a very, very important career skill. And so if there's information that you're not getting from your manager or ways that you believe that they are blocking you or holding you back, try to understand why that might be and figure out the right combination of messaging from you in order to get the information that you need. Of course, if that doesn't work, most organizations should be doing or do skip level, you know, check-ins. So this is talking to someone who's not your manager, but the person, your manager's boss, essentially, and sharing feedback that way can be a good way. I think the other way, which is maybe unconventional, is talking about these problems in public. So I am a very big proponent of public performance management. This is probably one of my more controversial management philosophies, but I believe that teams need to be coached as a team. And you're not going to find a sports team with the coach bringing everyone into a private room to tell them to run a drill again. It happens in public, and seeing someone else have performance corrected or their work corrected helps the team get stronger. It helps reinforce what good looks like. And that should happen not just from the manager down, but also from the team up. And so having these conversations about like, hey, you know, maybe it's in a retro or maybe it's in a different venue, but saying like, we feel that we're not able to do, we can't make this decision, this decision, this decision, because we're missing information ABC. That shouldn't just be a personal conflict between two people. This is a business conflict between the team and the person responsible for managing them. And I think those kinds of business conflicts are appropriate to bring up in public as a team and work through them. There's more accountability that way, and it just reinforces the expectations for everyone on each side. So that's what I would do if I felt that I was, you know, maybe had a manager that wasn't meeting my own expectations or was trying to figure out what my next move would be there.
That's really interesting. I haven't heard that as an approach before, but I think it makes total sense. Mm-hmm. I think that's really fascinating. We are more or less at time, so maybe to bring this to some sort of conclusion, do you have any recommendations of books or other resources that people might find helpful who are perhaps stepping into a CTO or a VP type role for the first time?
Yeah, there's two books from Will Larson that I'll recommend. One is An Elegant Puzzle. This book is really, really practical for engineering leaders, I think, of all levels. And there's like resources and like tables and things to fill out and do to help you understand sort of your map of what's around you and process design and other things. So that's one. And then An Engineering Executive's Primer is a newer book from him that's more about the executive role. So I would definitely recommend both of those two. I think the other side of my recommendation would be to lean more into your cross-functional, your adjacent functions. So for example, understanding more about product management and making decisions in product, or understanding more of the go-to-market side, which I think is a big, big deficit for a lot of engineering leaders. But make sure that your literature library when you're moving into this role really reflects the scope of your role and doesn't stay only focused in engineering. You'll see a lot of those themes reinforced in the Engineering Executive's Primer as well. Make sure that you're becoming a robust business leader and not just a really, really good technologist.
Fantastic. Laura, thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed that conversation.
Yeah, lovely conversation. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.